From historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this is The Seminary Explores. Conversations about people, politics, theology, and life with your host, Dr. Kristen Johnston Largen.
Hi, this is Kristen Largen with Seminary Explores, and I have with me as our guest today my good friend and colleague, Whitney Bauman, a professor of religion and ecology. He teaches at Florida International University, and right now he is on a Fulbright on sabbatical in Indonesia. Hi, Whitney.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you here. Well, let's start off by talking a little bit about Indonesia. For a lot of us, we don't even know where that is. We don't know much about the country. So say something about Indonesia.
Sure. So this is a common experience that I have when I'm teaching in the United States. When I'm in Indonesia, most people I ask, who is the president of the United States? And they say, Barack Obama. And when I'm in the United States, I say, who is the president of Indonesia? And I hear crickets. So what I start out by saying is, what is the reason for that? Why don't we know as much about Indonesia as Indonesians know about the United States? And this is part of the nature of the globalized world in which we live in. There's an imbalance to globalization. So part of my effort in returning to Indonesia is to bring more awareness about what Indonesia is to people here in the United States. So Indonesia is an archipelago of over 6,000 inhabited islands, and there are about 3,000 different languages there, which in the 1940s were unified under the nation of Indonesia, and they started the official Indonesian language, which is Bahasa Indonesia, and it's based upon Malay. But all the islands, Java, Bali, Bali's the one that most people know,
right?
Sumatra, they all have their own languages as well. But all the younger people now speak Indonesian, and that's the official national language.
And it's located just above Australia, right below.
Right. So it's in the Indian Ocean between Australia and India. So it has Malaysia, Vietnam, right around it, all right there. The Philippines on the other side of it, and Australia, and then India to the
northwest, sort of.
Depending on where you what direction you are
okay.
in the world, but it's right on the equator, underneath the in the southern hemisphere. So it's an equatorial chain of islands. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know this, but it's the largest Muslim country in the world. And so that's another reason I keep going back there, is because most people, when they think of Islam, especially in the United States, in a sort of quote unquote post 9/11 world, people think of, there's a lot of Islamophobia here, and people think of Islam as the, a very conservative type of Islam, and Indonesia has a very different type of Islam that I want to help lift up, because it is, after all, the largest Muslim country in the world.
Describe it. I mean, put that against the Iranian or Saudi Arabian kind of Islam.
Yeah. So one of the there are two ways that I typically use to describe that. One is that if you think about Catholicism, and you think about the Catholic Church in Italy versus the Catholic Church in Mexico or in many Latin American countries, that take on a local flavor of the Catholic Church in the way that we usually think of the Catholic Church. So it's the same thing with Islam in Indonesia. It adopted a lot of the local practices of the Javanese, of the Sumatrans, and this sort of thing. So it's a very, what I would say, not syncretic, because that's a bad word.
Yeah, right.
But it's a hybrid version of Islam. And I think that actually, eventually, once you start studying Islam from this way, or Catholicism from the context of Mexico, you realize that all religions adapt to their local context, but we just have this idea of a European or a Middle Eastern understanding of these religions that then we impose everywhere, and we think of these as the archetypal ones, when actually they're all hybrid depending on the context.
Well, we've talked about that before, this concept of purity versus hybridity, and I think all religions have a you might say, a mythic concept, right, of what constitutes the pure religion. And we see this, of course, in Christianity, even in the denominations, where there's been splits to kind of, oh, we're the pure ones, we're the Orthodox ones, and everyone else is somehow less than. But I think in the work that you're doing, I mean, you're trying to challenge those concepts and recognizing, like you were saying, that we're all influenced by the local character, and you've talked about the way in Islam this is particularly interesting because of the different way hybridity is lived out there.
Right. So if you think about religions, I mean, even in their origins, it's really hard, I think, to look at Christianity, Judaism, and Islam without looking at all three of those together from where we are right now. Mm-hmm. In the same way that it's hard to look at Buddhism, Hinduism, and Jainism without looking how all three of those grew up together and distinguished each other in relationship to one another. And so I think it's hard to say, like, what is pure, you know, Hinduism, what is pure Buddhism, what is pure Jainism, this sort of thing. The same thing goes for Islam. And I mean, another striking metaphor that I have for this is when I was in Indonesia for the first time, there was a huge anti-pornography law that was coming up. And one of the, a very popular actor in Indonesia was being brought up for charges because he had videotaped he and his girlfriend, and his girlfriend had broken up with him, and then she posted online, and he was being persecuted, put in jail for this video that she had posted online. And there was actually a huge debate about it, and the bumper sticker that arose out of this in Indonesia was, of course, in Bahasa Indonesia,
yeah,
but in translation here was, Indonesia, we're not America, but we're not Saudi Arabia. And so they're trying to navigate between these two very different identities of what they would consider to be sort of the liberal consumeristic West and the conservative traditional Saudi Arabia, Middle East, this sort of thing. So
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's what happens with all of these traditions is they're always navigating between something. I mean, Christianity in the Americas will be nothing without the indigenous groups that it's identifying itself over and against.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes on a very different flavor in the Americas than it does, say, mm-hmm. in Germany or in Spain, mm-hmm. or someplace like that. So,
mm-hmm. Well, talk about the case studies that you're looking at that brought you to Indonesia in particular this time. I think some of those are really interesting.
Yeah, sure. So there's one of the reasons I keep going back there is because I always say that around every corner I get to see my intellectual sort of understanding of life come to life, and this idea of globalization and hybrid identity and identity construction, it comes alive around every corner. And so right now I'm looking at four different events, objects, communities by which we might be able to rethink how we think of religious identity in terms of meaning-making practices. And the reason I use meaning-making practices is just because I think globalization has led to a situation in which, you know, Christians not only know about Buddhism and Hinduism and Shinto and all these other religions, but also take in certain practices from these religions. So in the U.S. we have Christians practicing yoga or meditating, you know, maybe it's just for health reasons,
right,
quote unquote, but nonetheless, these are parts of other religious traditions that we're taking into our own self-understanding and our own well-being. And this happens in Indonesia as well. And so, to make a long story short,
too late.
Sorry.
No.
The four of the communities I'm looking at there, one is a Indonesia, like most cultures around the world, has a third gender. And in India, it's the Hijra. And
I think, let me just stop you. I think for our audience, a third gender, what does that
right.
mean when you say that? What does that point to?
So third gender is, it can be a variety of different things. Traditionally, it has been what we would call in the United States transgender, male to female. In some fewer cases, it's female to male. The idea is that many cultures around the world have room for this transition between one gender to another, or this ambiguous third space where it's neither male nor female. And so Native Americans had the third spirits, for instance. And just about anywhere, any culture in the world you can think of has these sort of third or fourth genders, even. In Indonesia, this is called the Waria. Historically, they're called the Waria, and they are male to females, but they have traditionally been considered to not only be sort of musicians and artists and this sort of things that would be consults for the sultans in Islamic areas, but also sort of spiritual guides. Many people are familiar with trickster figures, and often those trickster figures are between genders. And part of what they trip up is the idea between male and female as these sort of hard categories. So in Indonesia, actually, there are many of these warias are Muslim, and they consider themselves Muslim, and they practice Islam. And so the way in which people practice Islam, they're kind of like we have Sunday schools here. But a little bit more like Jewish day schools. They have pesantrens, which are schools based upon Islam and reading the Quran for different communities. And so if you wanted to send your child to a school to learn about your religion, you would send them to a pesantren. But adults also form these groups to sort of read scripture together. And there's one community in Yogyakarta that is specifically for Waria Muslims. So these are what we would consider to be transgender Muslims that are trying to read the Quran and be faithful Muslims. And they are an official pesantren, which means they have been sanctioned by an imam to be an actual pesantren. And so that's one of the communities I'm looking at. How do you deal with this sort of local, historical third gender that has now found itself in a Islamic culture, right? That is basically gender dimorphic. That is that people are male and female. Now trying to assert themselves within a Muslim framework. That's one of the communities I'm looking at. Another one is an environmental Muslim community, which was started by a man who. Whose father was from Sulawesi, which is predominantly Catholic. His mother was Dutch Jewish, and of course, the Dutch colonized Indonesia for many years. So he was already from the get-go sort of a hybrid, and then in his teenage years, he decided, it was in the 60s, late 60s, and he decided he was really enticed by the hippie movement, and so he went to Australia for a while and became part of the hippie movement, but then came back to Indonesia, and he and some of his friends decided to naively, as he would put it, start a commune in Sumatra. They didn't know anything about farming at the time or anything, so of course the commune fell apart, much like communes in the U.S. in that period fell apart, because the people that wanted to start them started alternative societies, didn't know anything about medicine or midwifery or farming or anything. And so he learned a lot from that, went to Bali, started a organic farm that became very successful, and his son still runs today. But at some point when he was in Bali, he began reading Rumi and things about Sufism, and converted to Islam. And so he moved to Java, which is the sort of central cultural island of Indonesia, also predominantly Muslim, and started a sort of teaching community that is an organic farm. They do permaculture, but they also talk about rereading Islam from environmental perspectives. And so for him, if you are going to be halal or a faithful Muslim, and not haram or a sinful Muslim, if you will, that doesn't quite work out that way.
Right.
Then you must be an environmentalist. And so he's really taken on sort of updating Islam and his understanding of Islam to the context today, that is informed by the science of ecology and this sort of thing, to say, look, in today's world, you have to be an environmentalist if you want to be a good Muslim. And so that's another community.
Well, and I think I one of the things that's so interesting to me about your work is the way in which you're studying these communities and these individuals who are working within a tradition, but trying to express it in a faithful way in this kind of new reality. Because, of course, you know, you're talking about things that are very different from what we do here at the seminary community. But in some ways, the questions are still the same, right? I mean, there are questions around identity, who we are as Christians, as faithful people, trying to live our lives in this world that the Bible did not know, you know, that our confessional documents don't know, and trying to think about, well, how do we bring our faith to these situations and try to respond in a way that's authentic. And then also, I think it can be a positive challenge to the tradition as a whole, which is kind of exciting. You know, I mean, it can be really destabilizing and make, you know, kind of the tradition nervous, but that it also really infuses it with, I think, some fresh light and fresh insight, which is really helpful.
You're absolutely right. And in some ways, I mean, I don't know who has it worse. You know, in the U.S., we have this great secular divide between what is religious and what is what is public.
Right.
And Indonesia, they don't have that.
Yeah.
And
right.
So the way in which politics present themselves in the United States is that, well, you know, you have your religion over here and it's private, and you sort of work that out. But identity politics, like LGBTQ or women's rights, or these sorts of things, are all public things and they're secular things.
Mm-hmm.
In Indonesia, that's not the case. It's what secularism is in Indonesia, the best way I can describe it, is something like pluralism, which always already includes religion. So if you're going to be a feminist, you're a Muslim feminist or a Buddhist feminist or a Hindu feminist. If you are going to be gay or lesbian, which is, of course, different there, but you have to do it through your religion, you know?
That's interesting.
And so here I think we have a lot more impetus to just give up on the religious side and say, I'm going to be secular and do this thing. And in Indonesia, that's just not a possibility.
Yeah.
So you have this much more, these issues when they surface in some place like Indonesia, people have to work within the religious categories there.
Yeah.
They can't just give it up.
Yeah, well, it seems like in the other, I mean, that's one side of the problem here that you define, this, you know, this kind of complete separation where religion doesn't get to be involved. But then you also have the people who really want religion to be the dominant. And, you know, traditionally, like, mainline Christians have been wary of those people because it's a sense where it's not inviting a conversation of working through, but rather imposing kind of a religious ideology over everything. And that, you know, we also have that problem here. And so I think you're right. People who are trying to navigate the space in which to bring a religious voice into the conversation in a way that dialogue, you know, dialogues and is open, it's hard to navigate that because it's either like, well, my gosh, you know, either you're beating me over the head with the Bible or you've just tucked it away and not saying anything about it. So it's interesting to think about Indonesia as a place where this kind of fertile conversation is actually happening.
Definitely. And like, I mean, in some place like Java, you know, there is a real live and let live attitude to a large extent. Now, this doesn't mean that, you know, for instance, it's hard for me to get some of my Muslim colleagues there to understand that Hinduism may be polytheistic, for instance, because Hinduism in Indonesia has, of course, had to capitulate to the larger society and define itself in terms of the dominant Muslim culture, which is monotheistic. And in fact, in the sort of formation of nationalism in Indonesia, there is the doctrine of Pancasila, and one of the first tenet of that is God is one. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this goes for Buddhists, for Hindus, for God is one. Right?
Okay,
and
right.
So you know, you will get people trying to say, okay, well, my religion fits into this way. You know, but that's again another contextual thing.
Right.
Now, of course, here in the United States, we do that differently.
Yeah.
We say, look, these are my religious beliefs, these are my political beliefs, and we distort our religious ideas here to make room for the secular space that's supposed to, where our religions aren't supposed to go.
Yeah.
So we do a different sort of distortion. So I think anywhere you go, there's going to be some sort of distortion, based upon what is the dominant mode, of power, what's the majority understanding of the way politics, economics, these things should work.
Yeah.
So it's, they're a different set of problems.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, as we come to the end here, we could talk for so much longer. I find your work so rich and interesting. But I think one of the things that I take from it is how important it is to go different places, right? And what we can learn studying and being with and engaging with people in different places. Because like you said, I mean, they're working out similar questions in different ways, and there's a lot to be learned. I mean, we get a fresh perspective on our own context too, in ways that are really helpful. So
right. No, I think, I mean, as you know, like studying in India and Japan and the places that you've been and doing comparative theology. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things for me is to learn how other people see you.
Right.
As well.
Right. Right.
And to learn how that is distorted as well. And that you have the chance then to say, look, this is yes, clearly there are people, that you're talking about, right?
Right.
Or otherwise there wouldn't be a stereotype. But there's also me who is not Islamophobic,
who does
not think that American politics should dominate the whole globe, right?
Yeah, right, right.
Who does not think my way is the right way. And so I think that sort of telling those stories, being able to tell your story, and then listening to the stories of others that change your perception about what this country is like, what this religion is like, what these people are like, is just invaluable.
Right.
And I mean, you can never, I think, return to thinking the same easy thoughts that you had before in terms of categorizing this over here and this over here. So
yeah.
I wish you could see my hands because they're moving
in all these different directions. Well, thank you for sharing your story with us. Again, this is Kristen Largen with Seminary Explorers, and my guest was Whitney Bauman, professor at Florida International University. And thank you very much, and safe travels back to Indonesia.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explorers from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are those of the individual speakers and are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.